Good afternoon. We welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one special setting on our docket today. It's N. Ray Rico Daniel Reardon, cause number 216455-CV. I understand all the council have checked in and stated their allotted time and who is arguing. So if we're ready to proceed, Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. And thank you for hearing us this cold and drizzly January afternoon. Well, you know, I like what I do, but we've got, I think, really two interesting legal issues for the court to decide this afternoon. The first question is whether the mother or the parties can proceed on a petition to modify in the trial court while there is a pending appeal from the order that is being sought to be modified. And the second issue in this court is whether this court is bound by the El Paso Court of Appeals decision in which it was a transferee court from this court. And both of these, I think, are very interesting topics. As you can tell from the briefing, the courts of appeals that have decided the first issue, whether or not a trial court action can proceed while there's a pending order from a order affecting a suit parent affecting the suit a suit affecting the parent-child relationship is split between El Paso on the one hand saying that it cannot proceed, and the Dallas and Houston court saying that the case can proceed. The basic rationale for Dallas and Houston is that it can proceed is that a petition to modify is a new suit, and the family code vests the family the trial court with continuing exclusive jurisdiction. But that's about as far as it goes. We know from the history that we used to call them motions to modify, and we had to get more formal, call them petitions to modify, so that we can think of them as new suits. However, but what we have here is the interplay between the final order that is sought to be modified and a pending appeal from that very order while it's going on. And I think we may not get to the greater issue today about whether or not that can happen, because if we go through the facts of this case, they were divorced in 08, the parties filed motions to modify in 2012, and the trial court issued its letter ruling on June 30th, 2015. The first final order was on August 31st of 2015. Then there was a reformed final order. Then both parties filed motions to modify. All during the time while the trial court still has plenary power. So the court is modifying its final order in response to some post-trial motions. But finally, so we have an existing motion to petition to modify by both parties. Then we get, on July 26th, the final. It's called the second reformed final order. Then a couple months later, on October 24th, the mother, the real party in interest, files the notice of appeal, her notice of appeal, and then wants to continue on with temporary orders back in the trial court, but does not file a request pursuant to 109.001 of the Texas Family Code, which is titled Temporary Orders During Pendency of an Appeal. As this court held in Boyd, 34 Southwest 3rd, 708, that is a jurisdictional statutory deadline of 30 days to file your motion, have your hearing, and get your order signed. The mother did not elect to pursue that statutorily authorized manner to seek temporary orders pending appeal, choosing instead to seeking modification based on a petition to modify, a new lawsuit. So bypassing the specific statutorily authorized manner, we would contend that, quite frankly, the court's inquiry could end right there. That The legislature has provided a statutory means to get temporary orders pending appeal.
And the petition to modify was restricted only to temporary orders sought?
No, it sought both.
Okay.
And so, Justice Sutterith, I think we could have, that could be one analysis. You could stop there and say they didn't pursue that, they stopped there. Should the court get there, I think the courts could say the trial court certainly doesn't have jurisdiction to proceed on temporary orders, leaving the court perhaps to reach the greater decision of whether can the trial court proceed at all on a petition to modify while an appeal is pending. I see those as possible two avenues the court could pursue. Now,
why couldn't the trial court proceed?
Well, under the El Paso Court of Appeals opinion in ENW, the court reasoned that would basically render Section 109.001 meaningless.
But it wouldn't render it meaningless because you could still have temporary orders while the case is on appeal and also have a subsequent petition to modify, couldn't you?
Well, I think it's possible. I guess that's certainly Houston and Dallas's approach. I think a fair reading, though, is if you're going to look at a more general, I don't think the legislature had gotten that detailed or that microscopic, especially when you look at generally. Jurisdiction for family courts is when you have child issues, is right. We want to have that one court have continuing jurisdiction to hear this case. I view that more as not really a vestiture of jurisdiction to hear this case, regardless of whether you go up on appeal. It's really more whether we want this court to hear it versus other lateral courts. Like, we don't want you form shopping. If that's a court of continuing jurisdiction, then we have all these procedures of when you can transfer between underlying courts or when the trial court loses its continuing exclusive jurisdiction. And Justice McClure said, at least in her opinion, was implicitly, if not explicitly, says, look, and this court has held in Boyd that this is a jurisdictional requirement, that you meet these requirements in order to get temporary orders during the pendency of appeal. And Justice Walker, that's why I would say, is if you're going to look at the more general jurisdictional levels of the family code about vesting a trial court with continuing exclusive jurisdiction, that's, at least when we think of it, it's like when you're getting ready to file a petition to modify and forget any kind of appeal. What court am I going to file it in? You're going to file it in the court of continuing exclusive jurisdiction until the child moves to a different area.
From a public policy standpoint, the problem I see with your position is that what if something really egregious happens in the parent-child relationship during the pendency of an appeal? It could be perhaps the managing conservator parent goes to jail. I mean, there can never be a motion to modify or a petition to modify when there's a case on appeal of that order, the current order, regardless of anything that happens.
No, I don't think it's that broad, but I would say in answering your question in basically three parts. One, it's certainly not the facts of this case. There's been no emergency alleged at all in this case. Number two, there is a procedure for temporary orders specifically authorized. You file your motion for a temporary order pending appeal.
But maybe you don't know that the father's...
Correct. Now we're not under the facts of our case here, so we're moving out more to the bigger situation that I don't think is needed to be reached to resolve this case. But if we did, then you're in this, I call this the third scenario of, because these motions modified were filed before the notice of appeal, and so they certainly could have filed their request for temporary orders pending appeal if they thought it was an emergency. It was there, it was sitting there. They just went right past it. So we have this last scenario, this hypothetical, Justice Walker, that you're articulating, is that we have a final order, somebody files a notice of appeal, and the events that give rise to perhaps a new motion is after the 30 days. Under 109.001. Let's say 6 months, appeals take a year or so. 6 months after, so there's no argument they could have gone under 109.001. father, primary custodian, goes to jail. What are you going to do? The El Paso court says you file a motion in this court and ask for either an abatement or a remand to then conduct a hearing to address that one factual scenario under emergency situations. And I think also, I think the problem is to counterbalance that public policy is many reasons. One, the ongoing revolving door of litigation that goes on with child custody cases. If somebody's just going to keep filing and filing and filing, like in this case, they file their motion to modify and they're appealing the same order they're seeking to modify. Increased cost in litigations on the parties, which was our trial counsel made, was really what we think is the primary motive of what's going on here. Granted, my client is a pilot, but he does not have endless resources to hire multiple lawyers and endless hearings and litigations. Asking for temporary orders and not seeking temporary orders under pending appeal, which provides all types of relief.
But wouldn't, Mr. Michel, wouldn't it be within the trial court's discretion to just say, you filed this and I'm not, you filed this additional petition to modify and I'm not going to hear it until after the appeal's resolved?
You know, I don't know. I mean, if the court were to go that way and clarify for the trial court, because I believe, at least in our case, that Judge Wells felt like she had to go forward, and then we have two courts saying one way and the El Paso court going another way. So at that point, and she stated on the record, well, I'm going to go forward and keep taking evidence, and if you go on up, you know, do the writ of prohibition.
It just seems like the trial court's in a lot better position to determine if the abuse that you mentioned in your second scenario was occurring than this court.
I think that's a possibility. If this court were to clarify and give the trial court that discretion to say, I'm not going forward right now, and perhaps I don't hear anything of an emergency nature, like dad's, you know, been hospitalized or something like that, custody, you know, if it was clear that the trial court could say, no, look, you know, pick your poison. Either go up on appeal or come back and do your motion to modify. But don't cost us to do double things, because here's another bad public policy. What if the parties keep proceeding on the temporary orders, we have all this litigation, and the order on appeal gets reversed? We would have spent a year worth of litigation, and the underlying order's now gone. Or what if the opposite happens, you know, if the trial court does modify the order while the case is on appeal? We've been up here fighting this appeal, which we are now. We have briefing deadlines on the underlying appeal of this case, so we're spending money in both courts. And the trial court does modify the temporary orders because they want the visitation to change from Tuesdays and Thursdays to first, third, and fifth. Well, that moots all this, all the briefing we've been doing, all the money we would have spent. So you are creating bad public policy. I think the court should consider all the bad public policy about allowing two tracks to go on at the same time, because you got a lot of double expense and orders may get modified and we will all spend a lot of time and money just wasting our time.
Well, I have a question about the scope of our review. I mean, it would be nice for us to be able to clarify and write, but what's before us is a writ of prohibition, and I'm not sure we really have the latitude. Don't we either have to say yes or no?
I think the court could, in articulating yes, we're saying no, court, you cannot go forward for either of the reasons we've articulated, or perhaps I think you can say yes, you can go forward, but on these limited grounds. I think that would be part of your decision making under the writ of prohibition, because the court is looking for what is the scope of my authority to go forward while the appeal is pending.
But isn't it clear that the subsequent petitions in these types of cases, they are really supposed to allege new or different grounds or new or different facts that have occurred since the entry of the last final order?
Correct. They are
so
supposed
really,
to.
To me, that is what could allow a case to go on these two separate tracks. You know, there might be an appeal of the final order, but at the same time, maybe something new and different has happened that requires the trial court's exercise of its continuing jurisdiction.
Well, we would obviously argue that if that's the case, I think you will render 109.01 completely meaningless. Completely. And I agree. I don't know if there's any way around that. It is just a meaningless provision, because the day I go up on appeal, new lawsuit, change in material circumstances. Judge Wells, conduct all new hearings because daughter's not getting along. She's not having fun at school. She wants to spend more time with mom. And we're back in the trenches having all those double costs and double expenses. I mean, maybe they didn't do a great job, Justice Livingston, but they did try to statutorily, and the courts have interpreted it, saying this is a jurisdictional element that if you want to pursue while it's on the plate, in while the trial court can still do something, which this case was, you could have received, gone right down the highway, you got an express provision that's called temporary orders pending appeal, and what are they seeking? Pending temporary orders pending appeal. Real quickly, I don't know if I have time to get to point two or...
Just wrap it up, please.
Okay, and real quickly, on being bound by the El Paso Court of Appeals, Rule 41 is decided under the doctrine of stare decisis, and that's expressly in the rule. And we know about cases getting transferred from one court. I get about one out of three with y'all now, I feel like, on my cases. Everything else is getting transferred out. So you got the doctrine of stare decisis. You're going to create different tiers of decisions if this court doesn't follow the El Paso Court of Appeals, sitting basically in the shoes or standing in the shoes of this court. And that's what the comment to Rule 41 is. The transferee court is supposed to be standing in the shoes of this court. So what you could really do is get three tiers of decisions for all citizens of this district. You could get the El Paso decision, which you're going to, if you don't go with it, you're going to come up and make your own decision. So we're going to have two tiers of decisions, one for some citizens in the second district decided by El Paso, then a new decision decided by the actual Fort Worth Court of Appeals. And what if it gets transferred, well, before this court decides, another case gets transferred to Amarillo, because I seem to be going to Amarillo a lot. And we'll get a third decision if they're not all bound. And I think, granted, the rule doesn't say expressly, it reads more one way that El Paso is bound by a finding of this court. But in the absence of that, I think you still have got to apply, which the rule says, stare decisis, and the transferee court stands in the shoe like an assignee. So, and I think the remedy at that is en banc reconsideration.
That's what I was going to say. Even a three-panel opinion of this court, if there's three different members of the panel, sometimes we conflict with one another and go en banc. So I'm not sure that a three-judge opinion on a transferee court precludes us from a different decision en banc.
I don't think so. I agree. I think that's what we put in our petition, that if the court were to hear it en banc, that's how I would think the court would overrule, because then El Paso is just sitting as another panel of this court, and that if the court decided to overrule that decision, the proper mechanism would be an en banc consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Windsor, and let's add a minute of time to Mr. Windsor's time, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, I guess I will start off where Mr. Michelle left off, talking briefly about stare decisis. One of the cases I found on this is State versus Rhodes, 938 Southwest 2nd, 192. It was reversed on other grounds. But in that case, the Houston 14th Court said that if a rule is deliberately adopted, declared, and uniformly followed, there should be compelling reason not to follow the prior decisions of the same court. Nothing in Rule 41.3 says that the transferor court must follow the decisions or precedents set by the transferee court. It works the other way, but nothing in that rule talks about this court being bound by what the El Paso Court of Appeals did. And as a practical matter, several courts in this state get a lot of referrals. El Paso, Amarillo, I think Corpus Christi, maybe Beaumont gets a few, and several courts send out a lot of cases, Austin being the biggest, but then Fort Worth, Waco, I think Dallas are also on that list. If this court is going to be bound by what happens as far as the decisions of the transferee court or any of the other courts that are transferring cases, we're effectively diluting the power and authority of these courts. The government code set up the appellate court system as being all co-equal and independent, and yet what we're effectively doing is giving a few courts more authority to make binding precedents or binding decisions in other courts. I don't want to beat this notion to death, but I think that's important. In a way, you have to pick your poison. Every trial attorney knows that litigants in the same county may get different results depending on what trial judge they get. Maybe in the courts of appeals you get different decisions based on the panel, but everybody knows that's a possibility. If your case gets transferred, you may get a different result than if your case stayed here, and that's just good or bad luck of the draw. So in a way, this court's going to have to decide, do we want that to be our primary consideration, or do we want defending the authority and the power of this court to be a more important consideration, which I think it should be.
And isn't there also quite a bit of justification for further looking at this, both from the perspective of transfer or courts across the state, especially with the number of times that any given case can come up on appeal or an interlocutory appeal or via mandamus?
Yes, ma'am. I mean, this is the two issues, Mr. Michelle hit it. These are important issues, and they're kind of wrapped up in an odd little case, but they are important depending on what happens here. And the family law case is important, at least to the family lawyers. You know, we are always talking about this, and I will confess that this case is like a poster child. If you wanted to pick a case that could illustrate the issue here, this is the case. The judgment was rendered in June of 2015, right at the end of June. There were motions for new trial, and to be fair, the second order and the third final order, the main difference is that one of the attorneys had withdrawn from the case and intervened, and the second order did not dispose of him. He subsequently, that case was separated out into a new lawsuit, and then hence the third final order really isn't that much different than the second final order. Where Mr. Michelle's got it a bit wrong, however, is that mother didn't kick this new lawsuit off. Father did. Now, when the father filed his petition to modify, which the family code bends over backwards to point out, this is a new lawsuit. It requires new citation. We've gotten away from the rubric of a motion to modify, and it's now a petition to modify. So I think if you read the modification statutes that start Chapter 156, you get a whole bunch of information that this is a new lawsuit, or is intended to be a new lawsuit. And when the father filed his petition to modify, at that point in time, he had a final order, and there was a motion for new trial probably in the works. I don't know if it had been filed at that particular point in time. Mother then filed a counter petition to modify. So you've got both parties wanting to modify this order, and both parties in their petitions have claimed, and I think judicially admitted, that there had been a material and substantial change in circumstances since the June 2015 order, which was about a year before the father filed his, and more than a year before mother filed her amended petition, counter petition. So both sides have let the court know that there's been a material and substantial change. The second order, final order, gets signed. It's the second reformed order, which is actually a third order, gets signed. Mother ultimately gives her notice of appeal. But when the second order is signed, this is the second place that I diverge a little bit from Mr. Michelle's description. The father didn't file a motion in the trial court to dismiss the trial court proceeding based on the notion that the Court of Appeals had exclusive jurisdiction in this case. That's what happened in the blank case, which is cited in the briefs. Instead, in this case, what father asked the court to do, he called it a motion to dismiss. He asked the court to dismiss mother's claims and award him attorney's fees. Apparently, he was properly content to go forward on his claims and let the trial court do whatever they wanted to on attorney's fees. But he wasn't asking that this case be completely wiped away until he filed his application for writ of prohibition, I believe. When the trial judge in
our case... Here's the problem I've got with your position. Assume the court abuses its discretion in some kind of custody order, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
And that goes up on appeal. And then it's modified to change the custody order. But that modification also abused discretion, let's say, in this hypothetical. That moots the appeal, and then they appeal the second order up. In the meantime, that one gets modified, again abusing discretion, but it moots the appeal, and now you've got to take another appeal. And I see a potential gaming of the system here such that rights are violated, error evades review, by just tinkering with the custody order until the kids get to be 18 years old. Now, am I saying that trial courts are going to do that? No, as a former trial court judge, I would hope they would not. But I see the potential for that, and that's what concerns me about this approach that you have, that you can just continually tinker with something and moot an appeal, evade review, and just continually do that.
Well, I think a couple of answers. The short answer to it is that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did in Blank, is decided the appeal was moot. The Court of Appeals on its own motion decided the appeal was moot and dismiss the first appeal, the initial appeal. This, I think what you're describing, it's not impossible, by the way. I mean, this is family law. You know, we always like to think we family lawyers are special, and sometimes things are special. You could potentially have that in a particularly abusive case. However,
and there are abusive cases that occur,
sure,
in family law cases,
sure,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
Parties get very contentious, and gamesmanship occurs because,
sure,
of it.
This was a concern expressed by the El Paso court in the EWN case. In fact, they mentioned, you know, we don't want the courts of appeals to become revolving doors. However, I think that built into the system are some significant hurdles to that. First of all, you've got the standard for modification. You can't just file a modification because you think something's a little different.
Well, you can file it. You just simply can't prevail on it, perhaps.
I think that's probably right.
And the court has no discretion in accepting this. I mean, the court, if it's filed, it's before the court. Courts can't just dismiss things saying that doesn't meet muster under your pleadings.
I think that's correct to a large extent, that you would have to meet the burden of significant change in circumstances, that sort of thing. However, you've got some other safeguards built in. You've got all of the frivolous pleading sanctions that are built into Rule 13 and Chapters 9 and 10 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. You also have built into the Family Code Modification Statutes Section 156.005, and it expressly authorizes attorney's fees for the filing of a frivolous modification suit.
But none of those address the issue if the trial judge wants to evade review. If the trial judge wants their orders to evade review, they could do that and continue to tinker with it.
I suppose that would be possible. I don't see it as being especially likely. And I think you have to weigh that against the other public policy, which, of course, in family law, the overriding public policy is best interest of the child. I mean, everything you're going to read has best interest of the child tagged onto it, for good reason. But the other public policy, I think, is that through modification suits, we family lawyers seem to understand that we're always shooting at a little bit of a moving target. And I guess if you, I've never been there, but friends have told me you go to England, you go to London, you get on the subway, they always say, mind the gap. Well, here I would say, mind the gap, because what the position that Mr. Michelle's client would be advocating is a gap that doesn't occur in any other modification situation. In family law, when you have a final order, you could then file a motion to modify if the circumstances justified it, no matter what. The only time under EWN, if you follow that logic, that the parties or the courts could not entertain a modification is while a case is on appeal. It creates a gap or a dead space where no court has authority to address changing circumstances. And when you talk about litigants gaming the system.
Well, if there isn't supposed to be a gap, why are those provisions for temporary orders in the statute?
I think
isn't that what the gap, that wasn't that designed to fill the gap?
I think that my position is that the temporary orders provision under Section 109.001 and being able to file your modification suit, as happened in Hudson and Blank, are not contradictory to each other. They're complementary. You can get your temporary orders to maintain the status quo, to keep a temporary injunction going, or maybe to prevent a party from moving out of state, even though the trial judge had decided that they could, or to maybe continue drug testing or anger management counseling that wasn't in a final order. That those are more status quo orders. And then if things change significantly in this case, 18 and a half months since the initial rendition of the order, then you could go in and file your suit to modify if it was justified. I don't see 109 and filing your suit pending appeal as canceling out one another. I think instead they complement each other by addressing two distinct situations, the maintaining the status quo immediately after trial and the situation that can occur. Because you talk about gaming the system, you could have a parent who, as long as they're not violating the letter of the court order that they could be held in contempt, and as long as they're not doing something so egregious as to create an emergency, could create a situation that is highly detrimental to the child, which I would certainly argue is this case, and have nobody be able to do anything about it. Unless, under EWN, I file some sort of motion with the court. And my guess is that today, Mr. Michelle might be saying one thing, but if I come into this court saying that there's an emergency, he's going to be saying there's no emergency involving these children. I mean, and I would be doing the same thing. So it just creates a situation where no court has the power to address continuing and maybe significant changes in circumstances that don't rise to the level of an emergency or don't rise to the level of contempt. And I can't imagine the public policy of this state being that no court really has the authority to do anything. As a judicial economy measure, I mean, if I file my motion in this court to do something, I suspect that the factual findings are going to be sent right back down to the trial court, who's going to be doing a lot of the same things they were doing anyway. So I don't know judicial time-wise, I don't know that anything has really changed. The best policy, I think, is to follow the established rule of Hudson and Blank, which Hudson was just dismissed in EWN with a footnote that, well, mother cited other authority. And that's the only really discussion of Hudson, but it had been the law for years since, I believe, 1995 at the time of the EWN decision, to go ahead, let things work out in the trial courts. If the trial judge decides that things are so different that a modification order is necessary, then so be it. And what effect does that have on the appeal? That would be our position, and that the writ needs to be denied and the case just let the trial court continue what she was doing. If there are any questions, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Windsor. Mr. Michelle.
Thank you. Justice Sutterith, you're exactly right. It's gaming the system. Dismiss the appeal. If they've come into the trial court and said, there's a material change in circumstances, basically mooting my appeal, because this is a new issue that's got to be taken up. Under Justice Walker's situation, we've got father dies, father's in prison. That is a material change in circumstances. What are you appealing? Why are you looking back in history under an old order if you're now coming in front of the trial court and saying, oh, wait a minute, there's a material change in circumstance? Why pursue both avenues? What other area of the law do you know where you can pursue an appeal of the very order you're challenging and then go and then at the same time file a motion to modify?
But couldn't they be related to actually separate issues or problems or objections?
Possibly.
To the underlying order? In other words, a change in circumstance might be that the child gets ill, but the other parent still wants to challenge the findings and conclusions of the underlying order. So to me, those could be going on at the same time.
Well,
but isn't a new order a new order a new order?
A new order is a new order is a new order. If you get a new order, in fact, if this case were to proceed, right, what would happen, Justice Livingston? This appeal would be mooted. You get a motion to dismiss. If Judge Wells decides to proceed forward and set this case for final trial and they have a quick hearing, right, this court loses jurisdiction because the appeal is now moot. But I can't come up with a scenario of what you're talking about where just because a child gets ill, I mean, just I don't think that changes anything. It's who has the right to, maybe who has medical decisions under the final order. And they're saying that father, in our case, is not taking care of the child or not taking her to the doctor. Well, that would be a grounds, if we're going under that scenario, to go say there's a material change in circumstances, Judge Wells. Father is not taking child to the doctor on this date, this date, this date. Therefore, you should appoint me as the parent who has the decision to make the medical decisions. Material change in circumstances. Now, are you saying it's isolated and then you carve that thing up to say, oh, the possession schedule, though, should be changed too? I suppose that's a possibility, but that's not what they've done here. You know, Judge Wells found her to be an extreme alienator based on the counselings and the opinions, and she implemented orders to that effect. And so I think as trial counsel has articulated, this is a financial avenue to bleed my client off while having to pursue two avenues. Now, she does have a financial judgment against him for attorney's fees, but that's got to be collectible. And that, you know, family law cases and custody cases can go on and can go on and go on. But the real answer is, if they're alleging, as they've now said, that there's a material change in circumstances, why are we going forward on the appeal? It is a lack of judicial economy. The legislature has taken steps to address it. It in specific governs over general, which states specifically temporary orders during the pendency of the appeal. Real quickly, at the time our client, the father, filed the motion, there was no pending appeal, just to be clear about that. So this arose after they filed their notice of appeal, did not seek their 30 days under the statutory provision of the family code, and that's when we proceeded forward and asked that this action not go forward, and that's why we're here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Windsor, we appreciate your arguments and everybody's briefing today in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We will adjourn court.
All rise. Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.